another episode of Talking Clouds. So let's jump right in. You and I were chatting before, and I kind of wrote a quick little intro because we were talking about the theme that we sort of that I noticed. So here's the intro, right? And the whole theme of this was, and I think it picks up from last week too, is this idea that we're maybe moving away from the idea of spending the majority of our time writing code and actually managing what I'm now calling a loop, which we'll talk about in more detail as we get into the articles, right? And a loop is not really an agent, but an agent is a loop, and I'll try to explain that. And then really, I think if we sum this whole thing up, it's like kind of what are the AI skills that you might actually need or find valuable in sort of 2026? So I've called this, you know, I gave it lots of thought, the 2026 Agentic Roadmap. I'm probably overselling it, but I liked it. It sounded kind of cool.
So, it's got roadmap. It's got agentic.
Yeah.
Those words are all the buzz right now.
Oh, yeah, man. The algorithms are going to fire up. We're going to get so many views on this, right? For sure. And I got myself in the mood here tonight. I said to Kay before, I'm like, do we have that Santa hat lying around somewhere? It's close enough. I could wear it, right? So here we go. All right.
Very festive.
Very festive, yeah. Let's talk AWS first, like we normally do. Mm. And I sort of summed it up to you earlier that, meh, like there were a lot of releases today, but I kind of think we're in that post-reinvent malaise, to use a fancy word, where sort of what we're seeing right now are the things that weren't exciting enough to be either pre-reinvent or reinvent. Yeah. So now we're just getting them jammed in here at the end of the year. So I don't know. Nothing really jumped out at me. There was a lot of this service is now available in this region, and look at all the new EC2 instance types that are available in these new regions. And I just kind of moved on. Was there anything that jumped out?
I'll take a look later at the EKS items I saw, which were kind of interesting. There's some more networking configuration you could do with EKS, more granular network access controls, but it's very nitty gritty security options.
Yeah. I kind of was like, whatever. And then I started reading all the articles, and that got me all the articles we're going to talk about now, and that got me more excited. So let's transition over to the interesting stuff. And the first thing is kind of this idea of what do we mean when we actually say an agent, right? And I think still now, that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people, right? You say agent and you have a certain thing in your head, and the definition in my head is different. So you shared a really interesting article. It was back from September this year, and I kind of paraphrased it. And here's what I took as the author's idea of an agent, right? We've got tools, probably more than one tool, right? A group of tools. We've got some sort of loop, meaning that we're going to continue to go through these tools until the agent is able to satisfy the goal. So we've got tools with a loop and a goal. And without all those three things together, you don't actually have an agent. So first, is my take on that reasonably sane? What do you think?
I think so. And I think Simon Willison, this is the blog that we were reading, has put it quite well. Essentially, if you don't have the loop, you're just telling the LLM to one-shot the thing, right? It'll go off and try and do its best to create something useful according to the prompt that you give it and the context that it has. But if you don't have a way to iterate and verify, then you're kind of gambling, essentially, right?
Yeah, that was my take on it as well. And the other thing that kind of jumped out at me in the article were some themes that we talked about, I think, last week. And the idea, and I think this came from the Doctorow sort of podcast that we talked about, and the article sort of, I guess it was almost a transcript of the talk, right, that he did. And there was that picture, the bottom, actually two images at the bottom of that post that I thought were really interesting. One of them was like a, it looked like a picture of an old IBM manual or something like that. And I'm paraphrasing again, but it basically said like computers can't be held responsible.
Right.
In the end, it's the human that's responsible, which kind of goes back to last week and the idea of just in the end, if the AI doesn't do what you expected it to do, it's your fault, not the AI's. So I thought there's common theme there again. And then I guess the other thing that jumped out at me was the cartoon at the very bottom. Right. And I think sort of the takeaway that I had from this article is, Now if we agree on that definition, right? Tools with a loop and an outcome or a goal is really what an agent is. Then at the bottom, that little cartoon from, I don't know where it was, but, you know, kind of on the bell curve, the left of the bell curve, basically a person is like, an agent is a tool with a loop and a goal. And then on the far right of the curve, you know, it's the same thing. You have the same outcome. But in the middle is where we're spending most of our time, and we're, I don't want to say overly complicating it, but turning it in, turning the definition of an agent into something that is more complex than it really needs to be. I don't know.
Yeah, it's, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I feel like one of the first projects you might try to build when you come across these tools, like these terminal agentic coding tools, is like, okay, how do I scaffold my own dev team or dev environment? I don't know if you thought about that at all, but that was one of the first things I thought of. And that was something I've seen a lot online as well, right? And that's kind of like the best way to overcomplicate this thing you can think of, right? So you're trying to scaffold a whole organizational structure when really all you really want is the ability to test against some list of criteria, right?
Yeah. So here's a, I think I am guilty of that, right? And I'll explain why. So I've mentioned to you before, I use Qro, CLI, almost nonstop, right? That's my tool of choice. And you read about these tools and they're like, make your own agents, like create custom agents. And I'm like, okay, so what do I do all the time? I basically live in Git. So maybe I'll make, and I'm air quoting this now, an agent to help me with Git. Okay, so I figure out how to do that and I do that. And then I keep all my notes in Obsidian. Like I'm looking at my cheat sheet notes for the podcast in Obsidian right now. So I'm like, okay, well, why don't I make an agent for Obsidian? Okay, right. So I went and I did that. But now when I look at this really simple definition, are those really agents? Like they are in the sense that I've given them access to a set of tools, right? Obsidian is a tool, Git as a tool. But have I really, I'm not really using this idea of a loop. Like it's still one shot, right? Like as an example on my Git agent, I switch to my Git agent and I say, look at all the changes, commit them, and then push it to the repo.
Right.
Like it's not figuring it out itself on what to do. It's not, I haven't given it a goal that says something like, make sure every change that happens is committed to the repo and it just goes off and does it itself. I'm prompting it to do that every time. Today, I'm working on a really complex problem. I'm like, you know, this is going to come up again. I guarantee it. So why don't I put that in my vault? So next time I don't have to think about it. I know it's in the vault and I can go look at it. Right.
Yeah.
Same thing. There's no loop there. There's no goal there. It's just a tool that I've given Qro access to. And I say, this is a really important conversation. Put it in my vault.
Yeah.
That's not an agent.
Right? No, I think what this, I agree. I think what the equivalent that is most like this in the modern or the state of the art of these tools is that this is a skill that you've made, right?
Yeah.
This is like a thing that an agent can do if they pick up this file or if you point them to this procedure, they can go and execute that, right?
Yeah. And let's save that because I think that's a good thing to talk about later. So this article and I'll put it in the show notes. Like I think this having a definition for something that we can all agree on is really step one. And I know we're well past all of this now, but when you shared this with me, I was like, oh, you know what? Like, that makes a lot of sense. And nobody's explained it to me with those three simple components.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was good, which actually builds on the next article that I want to bring up. And this was one from Skeptrune or something like that. I'm not sure. I didn't write down who the author was, but it was prompt the loop when using coding agents. And and this article is actually what referred to that older article from Simon, right, about back from September. Yes. and sort of defining what an agent really was. So couple notes I wrote down for myself. And I think you and I have used these terms before, maybe not on the podcast, but we've, you know, just chatting, and we talk about like a one shot where you just,
right,
you enter something and you hit enter and you hope for the best. Right. And, and I, my takeaway from that, like, cause he mentions this idea of a one shot versus a loop. And I, you know, the takeaway from that article was, okay, one shots are really where prompt engineering came from, because the likelihood of you getting what you want back from that, I almost said agent, it's not an agent, right? From that tool, right?
Yeah.
Is probably slim to none. So then you end up spending all of your time trying to, in the most, a large amount of detail, you engineer a prompt to hit enter and get a better result. And then you end up with a giant prompt this long that you've spent a couple hours working on, because you're still one-shotting it. You're hitting enter and hoping for the best. So, you know, the takeaway there was one shot versus loops, where the agent sort of learns and you're the human in that loop. That was my sort of overall take. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, like the old way of doing the one-shot approach, right? You're essentially trying to engineer the perfect context that will get you the deterministic output that you want every time, right? What are the things, what are the context I can give this agent or this LLM, actually, such that it will deliver on this coding problem I've given it or this task that I've assigned it, right? I think it's kind of interesting to see. If you look at like Claude Code, for example, that's an agentic tool now, right? Mm-hmm. So if you take a look at that, if you just ask it to do a specific task, you're essentially asking it to one-shot the thing, right? Because it's not validating it. But where these workflows really shine, I think, is if you have the testing framework set up already, and then, or you ask it to scaffold tests and you validate that first. So test-driven development is kind of where these things really knock it out of the park, I've found.
Yeah. Which the irony is, right? Like, how long has test-driven development been around? It's been around forever, right? Write your tests first and then build your solution to satisfy those tests. And, you know, all the new things are the same as the old things. We just talk about them in different ways. Right? And the other thing that kind of I jotted down in my notes on the second article was, again, it reminded me of the conversation we were having last week about Werner Vogel's keynote, right? In the sense that one of the takeaways from that keynote that I took was that he said something along the lines of, we're going to be spending more of our time verifying the code, not writing the code. Because these tools are really great at writing code way faster than we can do. But it's still important, obviously, that we understand what that code does before we just let it do its thing, right? So I kind of thought, again, that article reminded me of a couple of the comments that he made during his keynote.
Well, it's like you look at I'm going to pull up Claude Code as an example now, but recently they've added subagents, right? So the main Opus, if you're running Opus 4.5 and it as part of your TUI, it can call up and launch agents in the background and run background processes, right? You have the potential to generate a lot of relatively cheap code compared to if someone actually wrote it, right?
Yeah.
But that's a lot of opportunities for something to not be designed quite right or for something to slip in. So that's where the testing comes in as an essential part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess the story is the same. Write your tests first and then make sure that your code satisfies those tests. What else did I write down about this? You know, it's funny.
Did you think it was?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say, I thought it was really interesting in that if you kind of think of an LLM as a computer, right, or an operating system, you see that come up a lot recently. If you think of the fact that there are circuits inside of there of, you know, arrangements of neurons in a series of stack neural nets in the transformer or whatnot, right? The fact that you can use language like do and while and until in the actual prompt is interesting, and that can kick it off into those kind of verification and code loops. So that's something I thought was cool.
Yeah, that is cool. But I hadn't really thought of it that way. I keep thinking about it from, like, I don't want to say non-technical, but I my brain keeps going back to this idea of how this is changing, like, how we're going to be successful. And it goes back to that same sort of thing, right? Like, the idea of do you have to, like, you still need to know what the heck it is you're doing, right? Obviously.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, like, it's not like you need to know that 800-page manual anymore, right?
No.
But you need to still exercise good human judgment. I'm going to let it write the code for me, but I know enough about this because I've been doing it for a while that I can look at that and go, that just doesn't, that's not right. Like I think one of the articles says the scars, right? Like I have the scars of having to do this. And then you're like, oh, wait, right? Like, are you sure that's the best way to do this? And I think, you know, the theme again is, you know, as you become more senior in your role, it's sort of understanding the outcomes and understanding what the syntax should look like. And really the value becomes our human judgment. Like on the surface, this looks good, but let's go verify it. And I think, again, that comes with the tests that you mentioned. That's what keeps rolling around in my head on this stuff. And you've got, like, the more junior people being more like operators. You and I were talking about this before we started, right?
Yeah.
And they're the operators of what we'll talk about a little later on, whereas the senior people are more like the auditors or the verification of what it is that we're churning out. Does this make sense, right? Will this satisfy our requirements?
Right. It's taste almost, right? It's that hard-won kind of experience that you only get by failing. That's what it comes out to.
Yeah. Which is I'll say one more thing. And this is, again, non-technical, but I think it leads to some conversations we're going to have later on, is this idea of, as much as being a technical person, I hate saying this out loud, but I'm noticing even myself that writing and documentation, they've always been important skills, right? And I know as technical people, we sometimes overlook that because I don't want to, you know, that's no fun. I don't want to write the documentation, right? I want to do the fun stuff and then move on to the next fun bit of activity. But increasingly what I'm seeing is that being able to articulate the outcomes, the goal that you want, like having good writing skills, having good documentation skills, although you could have your LLM, your tool, generate that documentation for you, being able to do those things yourself, to write the documentation and then have your tools sort of verify it, or not verify it, but, you know, does this actually make sense? I think that's those two things, writing and documentation, are an increasingly important skill. Again, not technical, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, well, writing is thinking, right? In my mind, like,
okay,
if you are writing something down, you are putting your thoughts on paper, and you have to actually work through and think about what the thing is. So you're taking that in and you're evaluating, you're manipulating that, right?
Yeah.
So if you are going to go in and read all this code, and you should at least be able to kind of outline what it does, right? Maybe you can set up a pattern where, okay, here's kind of the structure I want for this documentation. Can you go and populate the rest of the endpoints that we spun up and whatnot?
Yeah.
And then verify it. But Yeah, writing is thinking, and that's going to be more critical.
Yeah.
Critical thinking, I guess.
You made me think of one other thing, because I'm increasingly doing this, like standards documents, right? Like,
yeah.
And that, again, kind of goes to something we'll talk later on, but like, this is what it should look like. So before you suggest anything to me, make sure you understand the standards. Here they are, right?
Yeah.
If you're unsure, don't assume. Ask questions before you start spitting out options at me. I've found that I have some standards documents for some infrastructures code and pipelines and stuff. And what I've found is if I try to one-shot something, it might be okay. But then I'm like, wait a second, what about like how the pipeline's supposed to work, right? We've got some checks that need to be done. They're not here. What if I'm defining something as code, right? Well, I've got a standard set of tags. They're not here.
Yeah.
But if I feed it in those CI standards, feed it in our infrastructure as code standards, whether it's CloudFormation or something else, I get much better. It's still one-shotting, really, right? But I'm getting much better results off of that by feeding in those standards. And those standards were written by us. We wrote those, right?
Right.
So, yeah, again, not really a technical thing. It's sort of defining what it is that you want in the end, or what you expect it to look like, right?
Yeah, but that's the testable part of it, right? Like, if you have your loop going, that's what it's testing against. It's testing, does this match the standard, I guess?
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, though, what's, like, the best way you found to get it to check against those standards, because I'm still trying to figure that out.
So I don't think my method is super sophisticated. Okay. So here's how I do it. I've got my standards in a documentation repository, right?
Yeah.
Really those standards, I know we call them living documents, but they let's be honest, they don't change a whole lot, right? So we probably go back and look at them every quarter and say, you know, is this still the way that we want to build these pipelines? Like, has anybody deviated right. from these? And if so, why? And does it make sense to include them? So they all sit in a Git repo. I, out of habit now, I pull that repo down. Okay. It sits on my laptop, and I say, okay, I want you to do X, and the standards for the code that I want you to write. Most times it's infrastructure as code, right? The standards that I want you to write are in this directory. The standards for the pipeline, because I'm not going to deploy it myself, it's all going to go in GitLab, those standards right. are in this directory. And I don't know if it's just shit luck, but just doing something simple like that has worked. Like, it comes back and it says, yep, this is the pipeline. I've broken the deployments down into, you know this, because you and I were working on this stuff.
Yeah.
I've got separate include files. I've got before scripts. I assume roles this way. And it's been way better than even if I say, here's an existing project, use that as your source, it does all sorts of weird shit. But if I give it standards, it seems to be much more reliable in the end. So that's what I'm doing. It's not fancy, but it hopefully I haven't jinxed myself. I'm going to try it tomorrow and be like, son of a... What happened?
It's gonna break on you instantly.
Yeah, what happened? So far, it seems good, right? It's not fancy. What are you doing?
Yeah, I've been messing around with the agents.md file and trying to get the skills working per the standards, like the OpenAI standards and the Anthropic standards. And it's hit or miss for me. I'm working. Yeah. I just found a bunch of plugins. I'm mostly using OpenCode right now.
Yeah.
And they've got a pretty active development ecosystem for their plugins. Yeah. So I'm messing around with those. But yeah, putting all of your, especially if you're a company, right, and you have all of your standards and practices for development and CI pipelines and assuming roles and security practices, that makes a ton of sense to have that in a repo and then pull that down. And maybe you could even expose that as like a skill, is to go and check this against the best practices.
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you could do that, right? Like, I had a great conversation with somebody the other day. They're like, well, if I was doing this in my account, it would have worked because I don't have to worry about all these standards. And I'm like, oh man, you're thinking about this the wrong way, right? Like, you should be writing in your own account the same way that you would write for this customer of ours, where they have insanely strict requirements, because you're going to build yourself the habits of doing that versus in your account, everybody's admin and it just works. So I'm done. It's not going to work like that in real life. nobody's going to let you do that. No. So, yeah, it's interesting what you said about the skills files and stuff, because that's I've used the agent's configuration for, at this point, Kiro, right? And it's hit or miss too. Like I have very strict rules that I've defined for, let's say, what's a good example? My Git agent. And right in there, I'm like, I've got my little prompt. I've separated things into other files, like, you know, a spec file, a rule file, all that, to try to keep, it's a JSON file that you pass in, right? To try to keep that reasonably navigatable, because it, you know what JSON's like, it's a little nasty after a while. So separate all those into MD files. I don't know how many times I'm like, okay, yeah, get go and do this, and it's trying to change code, and I'm like, are you reading your rules? Like, did you check the rules? Are you allowed? Oops, I'm not supposed to do that. And I'm like, yeah, okay, you're not supposed to do that, right? I could go on and on about some of the struggles that I've had with that, but we'll save those for another show. I think, like anything, it's just gonna, sometimes it's gonna go off the rails. I'm figuring out how to keep it from doing that. Yeah,
non-deterministic system, right? Like, you never know what you're gonna get out of it.
But that comes back to kind of what we said, right? Like, the idea here is human judgment is still really important, and just because it wrote code for you doesn't mean that that code is what you should be running.
Yeah, the idea of a genie granting wishes almost kind of makes sense, right? And a lot of, I think one of these articles goes into that metaphor. You just don't know. You can't say with 100% certainty what you're going to get out of it. So you have to kind of constrain that state space down with your tests, with your scaffold.
Yeah. So. Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit more about, I don't like the terms that we keep using, juniors and seniors, but it seems to be what's sticking. So the next article is "The Bet on Juniors Just Got Better." And essentially, I'm trying to keep all these articles straight in my head. But basically, what the author's saying in this one was that you're able to get more value out of your junior team members faster. I might be mixing this up with another article, because with using AI tools, they're able to get up to speed quicker, right? And the idea is that there's lots of risk in a new junior member of the team, because it takes a long time to skill them up. And what if they don't last much longer than that skill up period? Then you've kind of lost the investment on bringing that person up to speed. Again, I kind of wrote it along this idea, or I kind of made my notes in the same idea that we've talked about earlier on, in the sense that humans increasingly are reviewers of code, not writers of code. Mm-hmm. So there's that same theme. And again, from the earlier comments, the more senior folks on the team are responsible for overall architecture, policy definition, and the juniors are really operating the loops that we've talked about, right?
Right.
You know, generating the code and then having the other folks make sure that that code makes sense. I don't know. I hope I'm not mixing articles up. What do you think?
No, I think that's a synopsis. I guess the idea is there's less risk in hiring junior engineers now because of the idea the fact that you can speed up the on-ramp by essentially giving them a boost with these models, right? Mm-hmm. So you could probably, I imagine there's a big increase in how fast you can get to work in a code base. If you have a tool that can summarize it for you, point you in the right direction, you're searching for X module or library, whatnot, right?
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious to see there's been a lot of studies and articles recently about whether or not these tools are beneficial or detrimental to learning, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious to get what your take on this, because I have thoughts, and I think it's both, but...
Yeah, I think it's like any tool. It depends on how you use it, right? Like, if I gave you a shovel and you held the metal end and tried to poke at the dirt with the wooden end, it's not a very effective tool, right? Like, you're going to be out there trying to dig that hole for a very fucking long time. right? Oh, yeah. And this kind of leads into the next article as well. And I think I'm guilty of doing this myself. So I'm going to preface what I'm about to say. And this is a skill that I've had to learn. Okay. Here's the situation. I don't care if you've got a true agent solution or you're one-shotting it. If you hit enter, it spits some code out and you don't read, like it generally says why it's doing something. And then it gives you a little bit of code and you just go, yeah, go ahead. If you don't read that or you don't look at the code, I would argue you're not learning. Okay.
No. Yeah.
And I'm guilty of doing that. Like there have been times where I'm like, why the hell did you say that was okay? And I know exactly why I said it was okay, because I'm in a rush and I'm like, this thing's smart. And I say, just continue. I got some other shit I'm working on. So I've worked really hard over the last little while to be like, okay, if I'm going to use this tool, this is an opportunity because it is smarter than me, right? It's smarter than all of us. So in most things, I guess, right? But
in terms of access to info,
what I mean. It has knowledge or it can find things much faster than I will ever be able to do, right? But if I don't read that, I'm just taking its word for it. So I work really hard now to read what it's telling me. Like, okay, here are your options. I think you should use option one. And instead of me just saying yes, I'm going to go and read those options. And I'm going to look at them and go, wait, this doesn't make sense because, like, we were just talking about a different thing here and you told me to do X and now you're saying Y. So I think in a long-winded way, they're learning tools, but only if you are going through what the hell those things are telling you and maybe even open up a browser window. And I know this sort of defeats the whole purpose and go verify it for yourself. Like for me in AWS, like let me pull up the documentation page for service A. Does this thing, like, is this real? Right? Does it feel right? So that's kind of my take on it. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm going to go one step further. And I think that you should write code. I know, controversial take. If you are a junior and you're working with these tools, you should go and you should try to implement the thing that you're working on.
Yeah.
And then you should use the model to go and get yourself a critique, maybe evaluate this code. As treated as you would kind of a senior in that regard, because you can get a lot of value out of, hey, what pattern should I have been using here? Are there any code smells that you're seeing here? Is there any obvious bugs or things like that you can find?
Yeah.
And they're pretty good at reviewing code that is already written, right?
Yeah.
Or finding bugs there. So I think that's a really good use case. And I think that if you can tighten that loop where the person, you're going in, you're trying something, you're failing, and then you're getting an answer as to why it failed, I think you're just going to learn so much faster.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's just going to juice everything.
And I think that applies to anybody, regardless of where you are in your career, right? Like you know that I spend most of my time in CloudFormation, but increasingly I'm spending more time in CDK. And it's a new thing to me, right? And today I learned a couple things because I tried to do a deploy and it didn't work. And instead of just typing, it didn't work, try something else, I'm like, okay, here's the error message that I got from the pipeline. Explain the error message using the actual documentation because I need to understand what this means, right? And it gave me back, here's what it means. And I'm like, could you give me a reference? It gave me the URL to the documentation page. I didn't follow up with that documentation page, but because what it said to me in my brain, I'm like, oh, that was a dumb choice on my part to try to do it that way. Here's what the documentation says. And then I wrote the code. I went back to it was the app.py script. And I just, I fudged it, right? Like I don't know what I was thinking, but in hindsight, I'm like, oh, okay. So I went back and I changed it and I asked it to check it. And I'm like, okay, based on the error, based on what you told me, does this look more reasonable? And it's like, yep, you should try a deploy. I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like that. So I checked it back into Git and it worked, right? So like I learned something. So the next time, hopefully I won't do it again. Hopefully. Hopefully. I am human after all, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that leads to the next one, the rise of the junior developer, which I think is kind of, we've already touched on this, the idea of, you know, the possibility of rapid acceleration of your skills. But I made a little note to myself that if AI is doing the learning, right, are you as the human actually getting better at whatever is that you've been tasked to do? And that kind of, I think, just touches on what we just said. And the point that I wrote down here is this idea of being able to leverage these tools and combining them with learning as you go is really what I think, you know, to borrow a term that you hear all the time from AWS, like superpower type stuff.
Oh yeah.
Like you will be far more successful if you combine those two things together versus just one-shotting it and hoping for the best and just, you know, going off and doing other things.
Definitely. And yeah, I like the theme of this article, the rise of the junior developer, and the previous one, the bet on junior developers. Like the idea, the rise article was in response to another article called The Death of the Junior Developer.
Yes.
The thesis of that was that these tools are just going to come in, they're going to eat everybody's lunch, they're going to show up and cause a bunch of issues in that regard. But if you think about the talk that we went over last week and this kind of the idea of this kind of flywheel acceleration of your learning that you can do with these tools, you are, I don't know, it's kind of, it makes me feel a little more optimistic about that whole situation for one. Yeah. And then you're just getting, you don't want to be a coder, right? You would rather be an engineer. That's the kind of mindset I'm taking away from this.
Yeah.
So if you can do these things intentionally with the idea of learning how the system actually works, then you're going to be much better off. Because code is super cheap. The mechanics of actually writing code now is pennies, right? To get a whatever script done.
So. Yeah, yeah. And I think that goes back to Werner again, right? Like he talked about being like a T-shaped developer where you've got deep skills, but you're able to, and I'm messing this up, but like you've got deep skills in one area, but you're not necessarily just a specialist anymore. You've got this idea of kind of spreading yourself out across a larger surface area. I don't know what the analogy I'm going with there, but
generalized.
Thank you. It makes me think of that keynote. If you haven't watched that keynote, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the people that in theory will listen to this at some point. If you haven't watched that keynote, I'll put it in the show notes because I think it's not a technical conversation again, right? It's kind of what his thoughts are for the future. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
good stuff. Okay, so let's talk about the next one. This is from LinkedIn. It's did you happen to look up the guy's name? Matt Wood.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, Matt Wood. Who used to be one of like the head Gen AI guys at AWS up until a couple years ago, and I think he's at like PwC now or whatever. But he wrote a two-part article, AI GIFs for 2026. I tried to attach it to the themes that we've had throughout this episode and this idea of like, you know, human judgment, loops and stuff like that. What did you think about these? I'll save my thoughts. What did you think about these two?
Oh, man. It's LinkedIn is so funny. It just reads. There's very much a LinkedIn kind of style that you see. And I mean, I'm kind of wondering how much of this was actually written versus generated, but I like the thought of, I like the, where he's going with it in general, right? Like, again, there's that depth over breadth kind of thing, but I think you should, the T-shaped developer kind of idea is represented here.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that. Because the first comment I put was Gen AI ? Like I just had that feel, right? Like I was just like, obviously, you know, it is what it is. I don't know. It caught my eye because of who it was. And here are the other kind of notes, right? I think, you know, he talks one of the gifts that he puts in his AI gift list for 2026 was this idea of gift of reason, right? And I think, again, I tried to tie that back to the loop idea, like tools with loops is your goal. So you've got this idea of reasoning and human judgment in that loop. But then he goes on later, and you tell me if I'm wrong here, he does say something along the lines of, you know, the human part of the loop really slows down this whole process. Like he said something about this idea of the drag of business. And I kind of thought my take on that was, yeah, sure, it would be great not to do the boring stuff, but the boring stuff is really where the dragons are, right? Like if you just let the computer do the boring stuff, then ultimately you're responsible when the computer fucks up the boring stuff. You know what I mean? What do you think?
You end up in this situation of a reverse centaur again, right? Like this, the incentives kind of line up such that you're responsible for this thing that has occurred. Maybe you have no idea what exactly happened. What were the root causes, that kind of thing, right? The devil's in the details.
Yeah.
I did like the idea of the importance of the human in the loop. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But I think that engineering mindset can save you from that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it goes back exactly to what we talked about last week, right? The reverse centaur. Yeah. Like I went back and looked at that article again, and I remember I was trying to remember the analogy you used. It was a radiologist. Sure, the AI can look at all those images way faster than you can for tumors. But the moment it misses something, it's your fault, not its. And I kind of think if we glaze over all the boring stuff because we don't, it's no fun, that eventually that's going to bite you, right? And you'll be the one left holding the bag because you are ultimately responsible for that process and you let the computer do it. And the computer, as we said earlier, can't be held responsible for anything.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
If it goes wrong, it's a lot more stark in the terms of there's a much harsher consequence for radiologists or some other thing, but you could bring production down or whatnot. You could lose cost.
Or I'm even thinking on the non-technical slant again, right? You have some sort of agent that is responsible for reviewing contracts.
The legal aspect of this.
You just let it do its thing. Nightmare. Yeah, and it fucks it up, and then you're ultimately responsible for it. So I still think both of these, part one and part two, are worth a read. But it didn't strike me as being sort of like the other things we've talked about. But I kind of like the 2026 theme, kind of like what we're doing here is like, what's the agentic roadmap for 2026? Because, you know, we can see the future. I know exactly what's going to happen. The next one is AI, OpenAI adopting skills.
Yes.
I'm going to let you start us off on this one because, you know, full disclosure, I keep looking at AgentsMD, SkillsMD, and then I wander off and do something else. And it's always on my list of to-do. So why don't you fill us in on this one?
Gotcha. So skills are another kind of paradigm for giving these tools or giving these agents access to tools, essentially, to have more specific and predefined workflows to complete tasks, right? Mm-hmm. So the original idea of this was the MCP, the Model Context Protocol server, right? Where the model goes and hits the MCP server, gets a bunch of context back, and then wraps that into the context as it continues to work on a prompt. For skills, what you're doing is you have a hierarchy of documents, right? Essentially, still markdown files, but you are breaking that down into more specific, more granular kind of sections for the thing to work with. And they're building, essentially integrating that into the scaffold that lets you run these models is the idea.
Okay.
And this kind of gets around a bunch of problems with MCPs. One of them is that you can flood your context window really quickly. like you can get it way too much context and degrade performance that way. So if you can kind of chunk that down, or you can just make these skills available. And often what they'll do is they'll have like instructions to run a script to do something, right? Mm-hmm. Or some other kind of API call that it can make to go and get some data that you need for this prompt, instead of hitting an MCP server and flooding it. And that's kind of the general idea.
Okay. So a couple things struck me with this. And again, I'm on the non-technical end of this again today. I absolutely love the fact that everything we're doing now is Markdown.
Yeah.
Like it's same. Literally a text file, right? And instead of writing code now, we're essentially telling, let's assume it's an agent, right? Because, you know, you're talking about sub skills and all that kind of stuff. We're now telling the agent with a really simple text file how we want it to do that task. And then we're providing it through that Markdown file with a set of tools to accomplish its task or its goal. It's all a Markdown.
Right.
Like, it's Markdown, when you think about it, is like, you were talking about like, you know, this idea of the analogy of people thinking about this as the operating system now. Markdown is really like, I don't want to call it the brain of it, but like Markdown is powerful. Like this is what we're feeding in to our agents to tell it what to do and how to do it and what we want. And it's a text file, right?
Well, you think about it. The web was built on Markdown, right?
Yeah.
Essentially, the HTML is essentially a Markdown language. And it's one of the best ways that we have to organize textual data into hierarchical structures, right? Yeah. Like headings and subcategories and lists. I mean, that's probably why they love lists so much, these tools, right?
Yeah. So it just took us 30 years to come back to where we started when I was sitting in my university room writing that very first website that had the little mailbox on it with the arm that went up and down and you clicked it to send mail. We're back to just text.
Yep, back to
with back some to web 1.0. With some crazy magic box that just reads our text and spits more text out at us. Yeah. And you know, and the other thing that I thought about this is like, imagine the power or the value of building yourself a skills library, because somewhere in my notes here, and I've lost it in the notes, is like, because it's just Markdown, and I know we have a couple standards, right? Like the skills MD, there's agents MD, there's a couple other solutions like open source type solutions that are built on top of that or similar to it. But in the end, if you have these skills defined, in theory, because it's just a text file, I could pick it up from this tool or this LLM and drop it into this one. And in theory, the outcomes really should be very similar. So you've got now, you've built yourself like a toolbox. You've built this little library of skills, and you just, they're yours. And like, that's where the power is in what it is that you've built here in this little set of skills, right? Markdown files. Totally. Who knew?
Yeah, it's always Markdown. It always comes back to Markdown.
Always comes down to Markdown.
It's super interesting. This is one of the places I'm most excited about kind of exploring in the next couple of weeks for this tech, right? Is, okay, what kind of skills would I want in general? Like, what is kind of like the base toolbox? And how do I get that working with the latest tools, right? So that's super exciting.
Yeah, I, you're going to have to keep us in the loop on that, because
go. Yeah, let's go.
Because I'm trying to do the same thing. Like, I'm just thinking about these things, and I've built a couple tools, which I think are really now skills, not agents, right? And I need to translate the word, or translate's a word I'll use. Like, how do I take what I was calling an agent, which really isn't an agent, and turn it into skills, and then have those skills be able to talk to each other? Because right now, what I've created, it's really helpful for me, but I'm doing /agent swap in Kiro. Well, ideally, those agents should be able to talk to each other to get a job done, right? And they don't do that right now. So yeah, I really like this one. I think it's just, again, an example of standardization, right? Over time we're going to be able to swap out the parts, but the real value is that library of skills that you've built.
Yeah, and you just hook it up to a better model as they come out, right?
Yeah, exactly. Which, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was about to say the same thing, I think.
Okay, which goes to the next article about Gemini 3 now has, like, multiple levels of what I'm going to call intelligence. So they released Flash today. Why don't you walk us through that one as well? Because I finally figured out how I think I'm paying for Gemini at this point. But I can't take credit for actually figuring it out. And I'll tell you in a second. So I know enough to be dangerous, but why don't you walk us through the article?
Okay, great. All right, well, Gemini or Gemini Flash 3 or 3 Flash just dropped today as we're recording this. So this is, if you're familiar with the other Gemini models, they usually have a quick, high throughput but lower power model called the Flash series of models that they put out. And then there's the Pro series, which are the heavy duty reasoning models that they have more firepower but take more time to run. So this is the Flash version of the E3 Pro model, and it's pretty interesting in terms of capabilities. So based on, and I'm just looking at artificialanalysis.com, but according to the standard benchmarks that most people agree on at the moment, it's pretty much one of the best models. It's only, like, it's on the same intelligence level as GPT 5.2 and Opus 4.5. It's in between those two.
Yeah.
And it's the fastest thing that you can run on OpenRouter, probably, besides, like, getting a direct connection to the Cerebrus models or some other provider like that.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that comes close is, like, the OSS 120B GPT model, right?
Yeah.
Which is their open weight model.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. I did kick it a little bit once you sent me the article, and I figured out in the AI studio how to change the model. And I got to tell you, like, and I didn't do anything fancy with it, right? Like, I was asking it stupid questions and stuff just to kind of see. And it is fast. Like, the funny part was I had to get used to hitting command enter. I kept hitting enter. I'm like, why isn't this working? I'd be like, oh, crap. Command enter. And I'd hit command enter. I'd like look back at the screen. It's already jamming stuff on the standard out, right? I was like, okay, this is quick. So I think for the rest of the week, I'm going to try to insert it into some of my day-to-day work. And just because one of the things I read was even for programming type stuff, like, it the model is very high performance, and it did really well on a lot of those, again, the benchmarks that they use for sort of programming and stuff like that. Wasn't it like just behind the Pro model on speed for a couple things? I remember in the news release there was like a, you know, the standard bar graph, and it was like literally right behind Gemini 3 Pro on some sort of metric that they measure. I can't remember which one, which I thought was a little surprising, but
it's really interesting. On most metrics, it's very close to Pro, according to the benchmarks.
Right? Yeah,
like Terminal Bench, it's like 3 points behind. Humanities Last Exam, it's like, yeah, again, 3 points behind.
That's got to be my favorite benchmark, right? Like, talk about like it just quite sounds so dire. Yeah, so I did make a few more notes on this. So what I was kind of thinking in drawing back to our same theme throughout this particular episode was the idea of mixing and matching.
Yeah,
and I'm just talking about Gemini again, right? But mixing and matching the different flavors of Gemini, right? Like, so you start with Flash. And then your agent or your skills then could sort of, you would like to think that they would be able to say, depending on the difficulty of the task, or maybe they can't complete the goal. So they're like, okay, well, I could throw a little more thinking power at this. So let's not use Flash next time. Let's try the Pro model to do it. So the idea of starting with something lightweight, fast, and then being able to essentially dial up the power that you might need, the reasoning that you might need, kind of as needed, rather than you going in. I know that most of the tools do this. They basically are set to auto anyways. But I was thinking more along the line of this tool set, this library of skills. Is it possible to kind of say, hey, always start with the lowest thing, but if you need more horsepower, this is the other model you could use, and being able to kind of switch in Gemini as you go.
Yeah, like kick it off into a to-do list for a more powerful model, for example. Like, we couldn't get this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like I'm going to sub this in for Sonnet 4.5 this in the next couple of weeks and see how it does.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, go from there.
Yeah. The other thing that's... I think I'm in the same boat. I might kick the tires on some very specific AWS stuff, like as I'm problem solving, troubleshooting things, just to see how it compares with Kiro. Because I think I've said to you before, I'm a big fan of that. It seems to do a really good job. The other note that I made with this was, you know, latency is still killer. We've talked about the effects of latency on e-commerce sites and stuff like that. But being able to use a really fast agent, like I'm guilty of doing this myself. Like I'm sitting there going, well, what the hell are you doing? Like, why don't you have an answer yet? So maybe using these really, I don't want to call them lightweight, but fast agents as a way to reduce the latency, especially if your skills don't need it, right? They don't need the additional horsepower.
It's such a nicer UX or user experience, right? Like the pro ChatGPT models are really, really good at what they do, but they take forever to run, right?
Yeah.
So you can have that thing for... Yeah. Yeah, multiple, like 30 minutes an hour sometimes.
Yeah.
But if you can
get better latency and still get the results that you want by using something
the quality,
like Flash. Yeah. Yeah. Which, nice segue to SimpleBench, which I've never used this. This was the first time that I looked at it today when you shared the link. And I was kind of thinking my immediate take is like everybody has their own benchmarks and stuff. So I kind of thought this was a way to maybe cut through some of the hype on all the metrics and stuff. You test it yourself and find the model that makes the most sense for what it is you're trying to accomplish. Unless I'm misunderstanding what it does or what it's meant to do.
No, I think it's what it's meant to be is a benchmark based off of kind of basic human like problem solving tasks, right? Okay. So you have, for example, a prompt about, hey, here is, you have a frying pan and you're cooking some eggs and you have 5 ice cubes and you put 4 ice cubes in the pan at the start and then 1 at the end. How many ice cubes do you have if you're frying an egg when you're done?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you have no ice cubes, right?
Yeah.
Because you melted them.
Yeah.
But this is not so simple for a large language model, right? You need to have a concept that, oh, ice will melt if I put it in this hot pan. You need to know that the pan is hot because you're cooking something. So that's kind of like a benchmark to cut through the general noise of the current suite of benchmarks and kind of see, okay, how does this actually do in terms of problem solving is the idea.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting because especially for like GPT 5.2, right, that just came out, it's really interesting. It does super well on all these benchmarks. But if you look at SimpleBench, for example, it is like 8th on the list, right?
Yeah.
Under Claude 4 Opus, right? Which is a model from a year plus.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. Like, so are they benchmaxing? Like, are they maximizing for the common suite of benchmarks to get more percentage points on those? Probably. That's kind of what it looks like.
Yeah.
But also, it's good to have multiple kind of benchmarks you can look at to get a better picture of how these things will perform.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely something I'm going to poke at over the next couple of weeks and maybe over taking a bit of time off over the holidays, maybe just, you know, spend more time on it. And then the last thing, not necessarily related directly to what we've talked about, but I stumbled across an article today. I think I found this on Reddit somewhere. Was NVIDIA's plans to reduce GPU supply by, I think in article, 30 to 40% in 2026.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So my really cynical take on this was, I made my notes here, was that, is this a supply issue or is it a strategy where they're basically forcing everybody to stick with the hyperscalers? Because even if you wanted to, and I do have a reason for thinking this, even if you wanted to run something locally, you can't get the GPUs to do it anymore anyways. Or you can, but you're paying a lot of money for them. So why not just rent a slice of time from the big guys?
Well, you're paying through the nose anyways if you wanted to run any kind of model or significant model locally.
Although, I mean, you can run 120. You can run some of the smaller models, right? And it's funny because, sorry to cut you off. I'll forget if I don't mention this. Just this week, I've had two people ask me, have I tried Olama? Yeah. Run things locally. And I'm like, well, I have, but, you know, you don't really have the horsepower to do anything significant. But I thought the timing of that was interesting with this, that people are starting to think like, well, what could I do locally that, you know, do I have to run all these things on somebody else's compute? I think you do, but this will make it more expensive if you wanted to experiment, right?
Yeah. So are they cutting consumer GPUs or GPUs across the board?
Well, consumer by the sounds of it. I was just thinking, like, a lot of times when I read about this, and this might be my misunderstanding, is like you need decent GPUs to run something locally. If you can't even get consumer grade stuff anymore for a reasonable price, like somebody was saying, and again, I think this was more of a comment than any sort of verifiable source, but you know, you just end up with 8 gig GPUs and people are like, well, that's not enough even to run some of the cooler, newer video games, let alone try to do stuff with models. Right. So, that's the other thing that I made to my note. I'd hate to be in the market for a gaming rig in 2026. I timed it perfectly, right? That I got all the gear at the beginning of the year. This one caught my eye. Yeah. Was it you and I were talking? Like, I checked Amazon, I spent $250 and it was like $800 now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy. No, yeah. Crazy.
And I think this is probably just them cutting back on the segment, their least profitable segment, which is the gaming market, right?
Yeah.
So going to go and they have limited VRAM available. They're going to pump that into enterprise products. Yeah. It's kind of funny that like now the best way to run one of these models locally is like the Mac Mini. If you like cost benefit wise, if you spec out a Mac Mini it tops out at like 96 gigs of RAM or something like that. Because it's SSD and it's VRAM also, that's your best bet probably to run the OSS model.
Yeah. I was actually looking at a Mac Mini, not because I need one. I bought the printer instead. So my disposable income was spent on the 3D printer. But like I was looking at those things and the specs that you can put in those now, like with an M4 Pro chip and lots of RAM and, you know, GPUs and stuff. I don't think you could beat the price of that for the horsepower that you could get if you were interested in not necessarily just running local models, but like you got a beast of a machine there for whatever you would want to throw at it at home, right?
Yeah, I mean, you'll pay for it, right? It's Apple. They'll charge you $10,000 for that config. Yeah,
sure. At least. Yeah. Well, yeah.
As we're speaking, next year's
Next year might even be crazier, right? But definitely if you went the Mac Studio route. But the Mac Minis, you could still get some pretty decent horsepower for reasonably decent consumer prices, like according to Apple, right? So, it is what it is. Well, that gets us through all of the articles. Do we want to wrap up quickly with movie recommendations like always?
Sure.
I did finish my Secret Santa.
Oh.
Remember I was telling you it was like it's like the Christmas version reverse Mr. Doubt, Mrs. Doubtfire?
Yeah, how was it?
We both had a pretty good chuckle. You know what? If you're just looking for Hallmark-type Christmas movie, it's worth like a... you know, an evening sit down if you're just trying to chill out. We both had a good laugh and there were some moments in it. Kay had a better memory than I did. She remembered some of the ways that sort of how Miss Doubtfire ends like the real craziness at the end. And she's like, yeah, they did a okay job at trying to mimic that. It's straight from that playbook, but it was worth it, you know, whatever. And I did see Roof Man. You can stream that. I saw it on, I think it was Disney. So I put it on my list. I might watch that over the holidays.
excellent.
Yeah. So how about you? What did you watch this week?
What did we watch? We watched a movie called Locked, which is about essentially a guy who's down on his luck, who breaks into a car, and it's a trap. And that's all I really will say about it. But the entire movie is essentially, it's shot in this car.
Oh, okay.
The whole thing. Yeah. So that was interesting just cinematography-wise, and it was kind of like it was a good little film. Yeah. I recommend it.
I think our movie themes this time of year have diverged completely. Hence, yeah, like 100%. The hat, and I was watching another really cheesy Christmas movie. I'm like, oh, I got to go set up for the podcast. But this was like the quintessential tree farm, small town, drinking cocoa. I'm like, come on. These are written by Gen AI. Like, it has to be at this point.
It's got to be. There's like a pipeline for these things.
Yeah, they're just churning them out. Oh, that's awesome. All right, man. Well, let's call it here. This will be our last episode of 2025. Because, like, this time next week, I'm sure we have other things going on. Unless we want to do the Christmas Eve episode. That would be fun. We can drink hot cocoa and, you know, just... chat about Gen AI like, on Christmas Eve, just like a movie. So we'll pick it up in January after all the festivities are in January. Yeah, January I figured was more realistic. Yeah,
I like hanging out with you, Brett. But
yeah. Likewise, I don't know if I want to do that. I don't want to talk Gen AI on Christmas Eve. I'd probably get some serious side eye if I suggested that's what I was doing on Christmas Eve. Yeah, there'd be some discussion about that, I think.
Words would happen, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. All right, man, let's call it here, and we'll pick it up in 2026.
Sounds good.
Okay, bye.
See ya.